Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. You're listening to NPR News. I'm Jeff Jones, a senior producer for NPR News with Carrie Miller. Later this hour, one of our favorite programs from the BBC World Service is The Inquiry. And this week, they're looking into an international hotspot that's basically dropped out of American news coverage. They're asking, has Russia won in Ukraine? But first, we're trying something new to get you ready for your weekend. You know that Carrie and her producers are here every day bringing you smart conversations about the big stories of the week. And we know that you're probably too busy to hear all of them. That's why we have the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast, so you can take the shows that you're most interested in with you anywhere, anytime. Here's some highlights from this week's shows that we think you're going to want to download, along with some of our thoughts about those shows. The first is from Wednesday morning, when we really looked into Donald Trump's assertion that the fall election will be rigged. Here's just one part of Carrie's conversation with political science professor Joseph Yasinski. It took a turn we didn't expect.
Joseph, I wanted to ask you about that. Stuart Stevens, who was on the show before you joined, said that he has been a longtime advocate of public financing, even though he ran the campaign for Mitt Romney, who didn't take the public financing. Would it solve a lot of the problems that people suggest?
No, absolutely not. And I think people are kidding themselves if they think that Citizens United is some evil boogeyman that's buying our elections. I mean, Bernie Sanders did incredibly well on donations that averaged, as he said, $27 apiece. So if he could do as well as he did coming in second place for a National Party nomination, in spite of Citizens United, then that just sort of proves the point that Citizens United doesn't really affect all that much. I mean, if you think about what it is, I mean, Citizens United allows free speech about politics, and that should be our most sacred value in the United States, and that's why it's in the very First Amendment to the Constitution. So trying to limit political speech by saying that people can't spend money on it, I mean, to me, is very un-American and frankly dangerous.
So you really do not think that the kind of money that we have in the American political system is a problem?
I'm sure there are some problems that it causes, but if one suggests that money is just buying people outright, I don't think that's the case. Most interests tend to give money to representatives and,
it buys
and Congress
access.
Who already agree with them.
Doesn't
so
it buy?
It's not like they're changing a lot of votes.
Joseph, doesn't it buy access? It isn't that they're buying the politician. And this is what the politicians always say. Well, I can't be bought. No, it buys access. You get your call return. You get the FaceTime with the representative. You get your interests represented in a way that, as Robert said, the average American doesn't have that kind of access. Isn't that where the money goes?
Well, nobody's going to. In what system will everyone have equal access in a country of 350 million people? I mean, you're not going to have it, right? So access is going to have to be divvied out in some way. And when citizens go to see their congressman, they invest quite a bit in constituent services. So it's not like the congressman hides in a room with rich people, locks all the poor people out, and doesn't talk to them ever. I mean, the vast majority of voters are middle class and poor people. They're not just the 1%.
Who don't show up in Washington to have one-on-one meetings with their members of Congress. So wait a minute. You are saying that you don't believe that if you spend money, you get special access in Washington.
I'm sure it does, but I don't think it perverts the system to a point where it would be better to that somehow you could either get rid of all money or somehow it's perverted the system to the point where only people with money get programs. If that's the case, you know, why did we have the Great Society? Why did we have the New Deal? Why do we have programs for welfare and other social welfare programs? If what you're saying is true, then poor people and middle class people should be getting nothing ever. But they do get programs specifically for them. And the issues that affect the middle class are all that politicians talk about. They don't talk about issues for for rich people. Maybe they talk about them in private rooms, but the agendas that are out there for the nation are talking about the middle class, because that's who the voters are.
Unfortunately, I have to wrap this up. I really want you to come back and talk to me about this in depth.
I love the way that guy challenged you at the end there.
Yeah, you just like to hear people yell at me.
Pretty much.
That's what it is.
But that he had enough fortitude to not just sort of shrink away.
Right.
And that it was an idea that I think we haven't heard a lot of.
We should just mention that I'm not sure I'm convinced by the fact that money in politics doesn't change politics.
Right.
But we're going to have another debate about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what made the end of that show mm-hmm. really worth listening to.
We're talking about the end of the show, but going back to the beginning of the show, I have not seen the lines light up that fast on any conversation we had recently.
What do you think is the reason for that?
People are really thinking about this rigged mm-hmm. election. It's mm-hmm. everyone is thinking about going and voting, and they've heard so much from both the right and the left about whether they can trust the integrity of the process.
Well, and I think rigged has become such, you know, it's not only in terms of the election people have been talking about in terms of rigged economy, which we also did a show on.
Right.
But this notion that things are rigged, just it gets people wondering and curious. And I think that, you know, at every level during this election, on almost every issue, it's being brought up. And so I think as soon as you start talking about something being rigged, I think people are just going to.
Well, and it's not just that we don't trust the candidates,
right?
The nominees, although
it's a system.
Polls show
there's
we don't,
that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But we don't trust the system. And I've heard more conversation about that in the last 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's the party system or the economic system or the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. talking about mm-hmm. systematic trust in a whole system versus an individual who stands for it.
What would you say about the quality of the calls that came in for that?
You know, it's all over the map. Some people want to call and rant. I mean, you have people who just get mad at you and hang up.
Or swear at you.
Or swear at you.
I mean, it's a really good thing and a really bad thing when the phone's read up that quickly.
Yeah, why, Marquita?
So it's great because it hits on something that we've tapped into something that people want to talk mm-hmm. about. Like, this is something people have been thinking about. But it's bad when they haven't even heard the specific direction we're taking it. I mean, because we want people to listen. We want them to add to the conversation and not to just bring to the table mm-hmm. their assumptions. We want them to hear our experts who we've, you know, carefully sifted through to listen to what they're saying and then respond to that, rather than kind of what we hear in our own like social echo chambers on like Facebook or Twitter or like even our own households.
Such a great point. I mean, mm-hmm. can you be additive as a caller, right, to these shows? Because mm-hmm. I think we all know kind of the standard knee-jerk reaction to a lot of the shows that we're doing. Can you think kind of beyond us, push us mm-hmm. into a new direction? That's what, when you guys are screening calls and when I'm looking at what's coming in, I'm looking for. Should we talk about the Libertarian show? Okay, that surprise. Now, we all talked about this right after the show. We've had so many people say, what about the Libertarians? I'm constantly getting tweet, what about the Libertarians? And then we open the phone lines and nobody calls.
It was like, if we would have had any other political show,
I know,
we would have heard from the people about like, where's the voice of the Libertarians? I think we have that all the time. And then the one time when we're like, this is a show just for you. Tell us what you're thinking about. Tell us why you believe in this party. There was nothing. And
but maybe
it was
it's because
like,
they were listening. Finally. Finally, they're doing the show I asked them to do. I will now listen.
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, I hope so.
That's also the I think what we said right after the show was I was challenging. We had the national party mm-hmm, chair mm-hmm. for the Libertarian Party on the show. And I was looking, you guys had put together a great file for me, and I'm looking through all this and I'm seeing what Gary Johnson's saying about Social Security and legalizing drugs and all that. I felt like, I bet there aren't a lot of people who think they lean libertarian who know this about mm-hmm. means testing Social Security mm-hmm. and some mm-hmm. of the other stuff that he was talking about. Mm-hmm. So I felt like if you think you're libertarian, this show may give you a window into this is really what they stand for.
Well, and this year, a lot of libertarian is the alternative to the
That's
things
right.
we know we don't like. So let's find something
Yeah. Marquita, different. You were going to say?
Yeah. I mean, I think people flirt with this idea a lot. Like, I don't really identify as a Democrat or a Republican. Mm-hmm. And so here's an alternative. And I think that for the first time in a long time, people have really thought, like, this is a viable thing for me to look into, rather than there's not even a shot of this person getting on the debate stage. I think we're in a really unique time when a third party might actually be up there for the debate. Who knows what that'll mean for the election? But I think that this is, it's not always been so viable as it seems to be right now.
But the other thing about that, this being the alternative, as Jeff says, is then that allows you to kind of project all the stuff that you're ticked off about the main party candidates onto the Libertarians and go, but they'll solve that. That's who they are. And those Republicans and Democrats are never going to get to that. And reality check, they stand for some stuff that I don't think you're going to like all that much.
Well, especially if it's this reciprocal for both parties who feel disillusioned.
Right.
Like, of course, you're not going to make all of those people happy. It's just impossible.
Well, precisely. I mean, this is a moment where you have disaffected voters on both sides who are meeting at this place of the Libertarian Party we can't stand what we have going in our own space, so we need to find a common third place to meet. And it looks like, as I look around, this is the only place that is viable, so therefore I'm just going to say that that's what I'm doing. And I think that what we were hoping for is that people would take this time, like you say, Marquita, to dig in more.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if I'm a
I'm
voter...
I'm not sure
and
that
I'm,
happened.
I don't
you know?
Think it happened.
Yeah.
That's Tiffany Hansen, one of the producers for NPR News with Carrie Miller, talking with Carrie, with me, Jeff Jones, and our other producer, Marquita Fornoff. We were reviewing Carrie's Tuesday conversation about the surge of interest in Libertarian candidates for president. Here's how that show sounded, as Carrie talked with Libertarian Party Chair Nick Sarwark.
So, Nick, here's something else that Gary Johnson stands for. He wants to eliminate the Internal Revenue Service and tax us on what we consume. Aren't lower income Americans ending up paying more under these value added or consumption taxes?
Yeah, that's probably a consumption tax is fundamentally regressive unless you have something that's called a prebate, which is part of the proposal that I think Governor Johnson's talking about. This is a place where he differs a little bit with the party. The party would like to eliminate all of that taxation on individuals, where the individual doesn't pay a chunk of their income in income tax. And we wouldn't like to replace it with more taxes, because the real fear that some of us who have done more of this political analysis have is that if you give the Congress the opportunity to eliminate an income tax and replace it with a consumption tax, that what you're going to end up with in the end is an income tax and a consumption tax like you have in the UK. So I'm a little skeptical of whether or not that's the best solution to it. I think everybody would agree that Americans would like to pay less of their income in income taxes, and probably pay less in sales taxes. So,
Nick,
kind of the direction we're trying to move.
How do we run government and pay for some of the safety net programs if we're eliminating our tax system?
Well, so let's start with the fact that right now we don't pay for what we spend. Right now, both of the old parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, are agreed in that they will spend money that they don't have. They'll spend money by going into debt, by running deficits, by basically spending our children and grandchildren's money because they've run out of ours. So they're fundamentally unreasonable because they're offering the American people free stuff that they don't know how to pay for. When you talked about Gary Johnson saying, you know, we have to adjust Social Security if we want it to keep going, that's a fundamental truth that any actuary will give you and has given for decades, but the Republicans and Democrats just want to close their eyes to it. You know, we need to have a serious discussion in this country about what a safety net is.
Okay. Well,
even Friedrich Hayek supported the idea of a safety net. But if you take something like the ACA, where you force every single American to purchase a gold-plated insurance coverage with a super high deductible that they can't afford, and then healthcare costs continue to skyrocket, I think we could agree that that's not a good solution.
But Nick,
to the problem, and it's not a safety net.
So I hear what you believe and the party believes is wrong with the way taxes and safety nets are appropriated and collected today. How do we fund some of the? I don't hear Gary Johnson saying we're going to eliminate every agency we have and do nothing as a government. So how are we funding whatever is left to do?
Well, we're starting by cutting back on some of the things that we are doing. You know, Gary Johnson and Governor Weld, it's the only presidential ticket that's being honest with the American people that the first thing we do, there is no government agency that can't take a 20% cut. Doesn't exist. You know, the size of those bureaucracies, their efficiencies that can be realized. We're actually talking about cutting spending, which is something that neither the Republicans nor Democrats have done in, gosh, the last 100 years.
That's the chair of the National Libertarian Party, Nick Sarwark, talking to Carrie Miller this week. You can hear the full show on our website and at the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast. I'm Jeff Jones. I'm Carrie's senior producer. And this morning we're listening to highlights from the past week that you may have missed. You'll see a few other political discussions there on our podcast, but let's leave politics behind for now and switch to a surprising conversation about growing up in Jamaica. Carrie talked with Nicole Dennis Benn about her new book, Here Comes the Sun. The conversation left the book behind pretty quickly, and it explored some areas that had our whole production team here completely engaged.
You know, classism is definitely strong on the island, and also race as well, you know, racism. You know, we have a motto, out of many, one people. And, you know, we learned that from basic school growing up. And, you know, as I got older and I began to really analyze this whole concept of out of many one people, knowing that there's a huge population of disenfranchised, poor, black, working class Jamaican, you know, we are not in that mix. And so, you know, that motto was more like a Band-Aid to silence any discussions of class disparities, race disparities and socioeconomic disparities. You know, and also, too, you know, you asked about my mother again as a reader. You know, she saw that and we know it because that we lived it. You know, we are working class people. And I mean, right now, of course, I'm living in America. I'm doing well. You know, I'm able to like, you know, help my family. But back then we grew up working class. And so we have seen that divide. And, you know, now I'm living in America and also going back frequently. I feel more empowered to talk about this in my work.
I think we should explain how this works, though. I mean, what you're saying here pretty explicitly is that the lighter the skin color, the more opportunity for social and class advancement you have. And I thought I would just read. There's a character named Miss Ruby in the story, and she's selling skin lightening treatments to girls, and her business is very good. And you write, because of her, women and girls who were nothing before have become something, their newly lightened faces rendering them less invisible and more beautiful, worthy of jobs as front desk clerks, bank tellers, models, head sales associates, and in some cases, flight attendants. I mean, that's a real classism based on complexion that I never considered.
Yes. It was very real. You know, growing up in Jamaica, that was really real. And I mean, we're in 2016 now and it still goes on, you know, because if you look at our Miss Jamaica World and Miss Jamaica Universe, the girls who are selected to represent our country beauty wise and also intellectually are those girls, the upper class girls who are lighter skin, you know, and with the quote unquote good hair. For example, because, you know, Jamaica, we do very well abroad. You know, right now in the Olympics, our runners are running. But if you look at the hue of our runners compared to the hue of the beauty queens, they are highly different. Right. And so as a working class dark skinned girl growing up, seeing that, you know, you're made to feel less than, you know, like, oh, wow, you can't represent your country because you look a certain way. Right. So I tapped into that because now a lot of our working class young boys and girls of the darker hue are bleaching their skin like Tandy.
Oh,
you know, they're applying these creams, these concoctions to appear lighter so that they can gain access. You know, and the unfortunate thing is that people look at them as, oh, well, this is vanity. This is just stupid. But it's deeper than that. You know, they're tapping into a history that we refuse to deal with as Jamaicans. Right. And nobody's really talking about that as much.
And that historical element of this is what? The colonization of it lasting hundreds of years later. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Well, can I ask you what your how the color of your skin compares, I guess, to what other people your age in school and in your community in Jamaica. I mean, how would you have been perceived?
Right. So I'm dark skinned. And, you know, in all honesty, you know, I went to a primary school. First of all, let me take you back. So I went to a primary school, and at the primary school, that was my first encounter with the different treatment that you get as a darker skinned child. Okay. You know, we were beaten more, you know, or lighter skinned peers were not beaten, because what happened is that the scars would be more obvious. Right. And of course, parents could be called in. And then, of course, it relates to the access that those parents have. So, you know, I remember going to the primary school where, you know, some upper class people who want to save money would send their kids there. And the teacher would never touch those kids. Right. Because they're afraid that they'll lose their jobs, or if they, if that happens. But the darker skinned kids, they'll get beaten. You know, we get 80% on a test, and it's easy to beat us because there's going to be no scarring, one, or very minimal. And two, our parents are working class parents who don't really have the time to come in and check up on us and, you know, challenge the teachers, right? So that was my first exposure to that. And then in high school, you know, that was when I was more exposed to the class division. So, of course, I was going to this elite high school for girls. And most of those girls were, you know, the daughters of doctors, lawyers, like very professional elites. And that was when I really began to see, wow, you know, it's a totally different world. And again, the separation with skin color, you know, the lighter skinned girls separated themselves and eat lunch together. While the darker skinned girls, you know, we were like vying for these products. Like, how can we get lighter, or how can we be accepted? You know, so it was a really weird thing to experience as a teenager, because, of course, you already are insecure as a teenager. So to add that to it, you know, it actually took years to work through that.
That's Nicole Dennis-Benn, author of Here Comes the Sun, talking to Carrie Miller on Wednesday's show. You can find the whole thing, of course, at the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast. There's some really surprising moments in that hour, and I want you to hear part of the post-show discussions that our production staff had with Carrie. Here's my colleague, Markita Fornoff.
I have a penchant for the melancholy, I will say. I have that coming in. But I think this is one of those classic cases of judging a book by its cover and by the title, because it has so much beyond that. Like, she's not just talking about, like, here's how great life is on the island of Jamaica. She's like talking about really meaty issues, like of classism and skin color and sexuality, that I just was so taken aback by her experience living on the island and dealing with bleaching her skin. Like, that was just... that was something that stuck with me for a long time, which I didn't anticipate when I walked into the room, you know.
Yeah, the title does kind of belie the subject matter in the novel. I think of an author interview like that as just in the back of my mind, the whole package. The book is incredible. She's a terrific interview. And that does not happen all the time. I mean, we've gotten very good. Steph Curtis chooses all the books, and she and I work out which books we're going to do. But not every writer can get on the air for 45 minutes and talk as candidly and incisively and as energetically, right? With such curiosity.
And she went beyond the book, too. And you so often ask your authors to do this, which makes me nervous.
Exactly. Does it make you nervous?
Sure it does. Because can they go there?
Maybe. I don't know.
What if they only know what they wrote?
Yeah. I mean, Jeff, the book interviews are really not about the book. Because who wants to sit there and talk about plot if you haven't, and listen to that if you haven't read the book? It's about the big ideas that inform the novel. Right.
This is why I wonder sometimes if we should be promoting these shows and saying today's show is about, I don't know,
classism
in
racism,
Jamaica, right? Or, you know, whatever it is that is the big idea, rather than we're here to talk to this person about her book. Because I think, like you, Markita, there might be some people who are thinking, well, I don't care about that book, or I don't know that author, or I don't, you know. But on the other hand, I may really like to hear this conversation from someone who has firsthand experience in a, you know, growing up in a country where, you know, there's rampant homophobia and, you know, whatever.
On to next week. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
So there's a peek behind the scenes on Carrie's show. Our producers are Tiffany Hansen, Marquita Fornoff, Stephanie Curtis, and me, Jeff Jones. You can find all of this week's conversations, from political correctness to the state of the Libertarian Party to analysis of Donald Trump's economic plan to the latest from our summer series of books about dogs. Yes, that's a thing. It's all on the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast. By the way, on Monday, we'll spend the 9 a.m. hour digging into the specifics of Hillary Clinton's economic proposals, and you can hear Clinton's full speech today, Friday at noon, on NPR News Presents. Coming up after the news, the Inquiry asks if Russia has won in Ukraine. We love the Inquiry. It's from our partners at the BBC. But first, here's Phil Picardi with a look at this morning's headlines.